countries. First is GPT-3, and we'll get into what that means. Second is Epic Games' battle with Apple and app ecosystem in general. Third is TikTok ban in the US and what that means for the world and for entrepreneurs. And fourth is visa issues with the latest immigration policy in the US, how to make best of, you know, being remote, and is it what can you do when you cannot come to Silicon Valley? And in our last episode in Valley Nordic, we covered earnings of Apple, Google, et cetera, SPACs. So there were some of the other things that happened in summer. So if you're interested, you can listen to that podcast. And this episode will also be available on our Valley Nordic podcast later today. You want to add anything, Arne?
I think that's all good. It's much easier to behave when you don't say something.
And when we are talking, and if you have questions, just put the questions in the chat, because you may not remember them. The topics are very diverse, and we'll address them towards the end. So let's start with GPT-3, which I think, to me, the most exciting thing that happened in summer in the last 3 months. So to give you a background of what that is, let me share. AI in general is, you know, you have supervised learning and you have unsupervised learning. When you do supervised learning, it's you develop an algorithm, a model with data, and then you test that model with back tested with available data. Is it giving the right results? Then you tune it, and then with new input, it can predict the right outcome. Unsupervised learning is you don't rely on data, you rely on game theory and other rules where the model learns itself. You build in a reward behavior. If you do this, then you get, you know, points. If you don't do this, you don't get points. If you do something else, it's negative points. So I'm overgeneralizing it. But GPT-3 is exciting and game-changing. Is, well, first, it stands for Generative Pre-trained transformer. So it's NLP, it's huge progress in NLP. So that's natural language processing. So basically in supervised learning or machine learning, you have a model that's bespoke. You build it to do something. Here it's pre-trained, it's general purpose. So that's the cool thing. I think it's first big achievement in terms of having a general intelligence algorithm or model available. So it's developed by OpenAI, which was co-founded by Elon Musk, and now it's run by Sam something, I forget his name. He used to run Y Combinator, Altman. He used to run Y Combinator. And this is, so practically it's an API that you get access to. So you don't get access to the model, you get access to the API, which you can use for many things. So why it's so exciting? So it has 175 billion parameters, and each of them can be individually tweaked. 175 billion. So they basically, how they developed it, they studied the entire internet. Like there's a service called Common Crawler. So they got, 60% of data from there and other unstructured data, then all Wikipedia, which I learned when I was doing homework for this, is that's less than 3% of the internet, entire Wikipedia. And to give you how fast thing, to give you an idea how fast things are moving, GPT-2 had like 1.5 billion parameters, which were released last year. So not that long ago. And now you have 175 billion. Then the latest thing before this was something developed by Microsoft. I forget the name, I think Turing. But it had 17 billion parameters. So that was released a few months ago. So you see 17 billion and 175 billion. So it's unbelievable, the progress that has been made, but it's still the beginning. You know, there are a lot of things it does well. There are a lot of things it does not do well. So before I carry on, Arne, any questions? You want to add something?
Yeah, I guess it's fair to say that this is something that's been worked on for multiple years already, but there was a new release, say July, during the summer, and suddenly the Twitter universe of Silicon Valley just blew up, saying the world is never going to be the same again. That's kind of, it was like a big bang release in July now. But I guess one of the key things here is to talk a little bit about what can it actually be used for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So many things. I mean, it's so things that people have shared online, it can write a poem. So you can say that, you know, write a poem with that. You can give a command. Literally, this is all the command you have to give. Write a poem similar to or in style of Robert Burns on mice. It will produce something that is a poem because it has all the entire internet, you know, as a background. It can do that. So other difference here is, and how it's able to do that is, in the normal machine learning or bespoke models, it's predicted by, you know, what word comes next. So it's basically a statistical model. So let's say you want to, you know, say blue. So there is a certain probability that blue will be followed by sky. So that's the level of, you know, detail previously that happened. But in this model, in parallel, while it's doing that, that blue comes after sky, before sky, in parallel is trying to figure out the context. In the paragraph or in that sentence, does that make sense? So that's how it's able to generate. And it can do, you know, basic math, like arithmetic, just by text. So that, and if you're not into AI, nobody actually knows how the neurons in these models make decisions. So it's still kind of a black box. But in this case, you have the, you know, the context of the general nature, that's what people are excited about. You can also give it SQL commands. You can ask it to write code. So now you can, you know, write code. A machine can write the code for you. So that I think the excitement is about how the nature of coding might change, how the startups that, you know, are into AI or in that space, they may not have to gather all the data. They can use this model to prime it and then to, you know, the code does the, sorry, the model does the coding or the writes the code and then the humans debug. So, and some other examples I see, you can have an API in Excel, Google Sheets, where you tell it, okay, these are the two parameters. Let's say the example I saw, you tell in Excel, you type California population 40 million, you know, New York, whatever million, and it automatically will predict the population of any other state because it understands. In this column, you have the states. In this column, you have the population. So if you give it these two examples, it'll return what comes next. It can also develop web apps. It can write, people wrote articles or used it to write articles. And the middle of the article, they revealed that it's written by GPT-3. So it's very cohesive. Yeah. So these are some of the applications I've seen so far.
Yeah, so what it's called, it's a generative text model. So essentially it writes text based on an input. And so one other use case that I saw was that somebody had fed the machine multiple documents that person had written, and then they wrote the first paragraph and a context about what the document was meant to be about, and the machine wrote the rest of the document, and it was... So the author said, well, this is very similar to what I would have written if I had written a document.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
And for many of them, you know, the Turing test, that the if you cannot tell the difference, if machine is answering versus human answering. In this case, in the writing case, or many writing cases, it passed the Turing test, meaning people could not tell if the article was written by GPT-3 or a human being, which I think is remarkable.
So, Chandra, so far it's sort of it's out there, but yet it's limited access. Do you know anything about, you know, the plans for access and how like normal startups could get on the bandwagon and use this for something?
Yes. So you go to OpenAI, just do a Google search, OpenAI GPT-3 developer access. And then there's like a one-page form you fill and they look at the request and you get access to that. And this is also OpenAI's first for-profit product. So, you know, it was founded as like a research institute, but now they're using it to make money so they can fund more AI research. But they also acknowledge it's just the beginning. Yeah, first step in the general domain. So far, most of the AI stuff we have seen is in the, you know, specialized domain, meaning it's done to for a certain purpose. So it still makes a lot of mistakes, which are silly, but it does a lot of things really well. So to get access to it, do a search on GPT-3 developer access and you fill out a form and they look at the request and grant you access.
Okay, as a follow-up, do you know anything about like the resources and efficiency of this? So say you wanted to use it for a project, you know, would it be expensive? And likewise, is it resource intensive? So for example, one of the issues was like Bitcoin seemed like a great idea until you started to scale it and you looked how the resources scaled with it. And suddenly it's not quite so brilliant anymore. Do you foresee issues like that with this?
No, I think that's the advantage here. So Bitcoin, blockchain, et cetera, it's, the purpose is different. Here, the money they have spent already in training the model with the entire word population on the internet, just the cloud compute cost is in like in tens of millions of that. So previously, if you were going to do a startup, you know, to let's say you want to build the best chatbot ever, you got to get the data, train the model, and if you want to make it perfect or, you know, close to perfect, you need a lot of data. So that training, all that is gone now. It's already done. So now what you need to do is get access to this API and prime the model with examples. You know, it'll write the code for whatever you want it to do, and then you debug. So it's, I read somewhere, like generally Series A AI startup funding is 10 million. And the out of that, 5 million went on just training the model. So now the resource has gone away. Like you get that with this API.
So the resource intensity is in the training, but whereas the application and deployment of it is a much less resource intensive exercise.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Should we move on to the next topic?
Do
I have more to add?
See if I missed anything. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of detail I can get into, but we have to cover more topics. Let's get into your favorite topic, Epic Games and Apple. So you want to describe, Arne, like what is happening with Epic Games and Apple?
Yeah, so this is a topic that I chose to talk about. And so like the tabloid version of it is that this is Fortnite's biggest battle ever. And this time it's not a horde of teenagers roaming around in the virtual world, killing each other. This time it's the company behind Epic Games battling Apple and Google. That's like the framework of the topic. And I think a little bit of backdrop helps as well. So back in the day, mobile content was very hard to distribute and it was very reliant on operators and so forth. And then Apple launched App Store in 2008. And I think Google Play came along in 2010 or something like that. And the App Store model was initialized, where distribution through the App Store, essentially Apple and Google takes 30% of the revenues, 15% for subscriptions after 12 years. And as time has gone by, that seemed like a great deal at the time, because they solved a lot of problems. But as time has gone on, like the tech community, sort of dependent on this platform and the rails of it, sort of thought, you know, that is a lot of money they're making on not doing a whole lot of work. So there's been, let's call it...
Do they say that about VCs also? They make a lot of money without doing anything?
No, we're universally loved. So this satisfaction has grown, and sort of there's been a push by the industry to sort of circumvent or have them cut like their share of the revenues, or opening up for other ways of taking payment and going through the App Store and so forth. But Google and Apple has persisted, although there are two sort of modes in the App Store. One is called a reader. So say Netflix, for example, is a reader. You can buy a subscription on a different platform. You cannot buy one in the platform, and you're allowed to view content. But that is only allowed for like content only. And there's one called the cross-platform app category, where you can buy subscriptions on the web or elsewhere. But if you have to sell the subscriptions or transactions on the platform, and then Apple or Google takes 30%. So those are the sort of the ways of getting some of the revenue streams off the platform. But nevertheless, it's hard to get any special deals. It's kind of opaque when you're allowed to do these things, and you're certainly not allowed to run transactions in the apps without them taking a cut. That is for sure. And so this sort of is part of the overall view that these companies are misusing their market power or monopoly positions to some extent. So there are antitrust investigations both in the EU and the US around Apple and Google. And then sort of this thing flared up again in June this year, where an app called Hey sort of got into public battle with Apple. And that sort of ended with a truce where nothing is really solved. And then about 2 weeks ago, Epic Games sort of blew this battle wide open. And essentially what they did was that they launched Fortnite with a pay inside the app for virtual currency at a 20% discount and circumventing the App Store revenue stream. And also launched a pretty big campaign. The result of this launch was essentially that Apple retaliated and blocked Fortnite, which is a huge app. And Google followed suit, blocking the app from the App Store. And lawsuits essentially commenced. So Apple both blocked Fortnite as well. It's worth mentioning that Fortnite is a... possibly the most successful game in the world at this time. And it's made by a company called Epic Games that also provides the game engine called Unreal. And so a lot of other games in the app stores run on Unreal. So when Apple retaliated, they both closed Fortnite from the App Store, but also the developers' access to the Unreal gaming engine. And so the situation now is that... And Epic Games is not a small company. It's a $17 billion company itself. So it's like a formidable force in itself, even if it's not a listed company. And also companies like Facebook and everything joined the campaign against Apple and Google in this instance. So the situation now is that Fortnite is still locked out of the App Store. But the court decision has been that Apple cannot block the developers' access to the Unreal Engine. So for the time being, I would call it a tie, but it's a galactic battle of the rules of being on the mobile ecosystems in the West. And so why does this matter to people who are not $17 billion companies? Well, I think think it's very important that App Store and Play are the biggest digital distribution platforms that are out there. And the terms of service and the margins you can make on that are essentially the rules of the game of how you can make money in this ecosystem. And that impacts small and large companies, and also will redefine both the boundaries for innovation and competition in the space. I think it's definitely a battle to follow.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Arne. So let me add a couple of things. One, the 30% number is not arbitrary. It comes from how the retailers charge the manufacturer. So if you buy something, let's say at Best Buy or any retail store, Walmart, the general rule is you pay 30% to them. So they follow that model because they saw that as a retail store. Second, they don't charge anything if you're buying physical things. It's only for digital goods like, movies, books, any games, etc. But if you're buying, let's say, something on Amazon, which is, a phone or whatever, then they don't charge anything. And just the app economy now, just Apple is $500 billion. They facilitate business worth $500 billion. And Google might be half of that. So it's like, close to trillion. So Arne, what is your view? You are more on you think Apple is right to charge 30%, or you think you're more on the Fortnite side that, they shouldn't have to pay, or that people should have an option to bypass Apple payment system?
I'm probably marginally on the Epic side here. And now, so if you take a step back, I think before the App Store it was very cumbersome to do digital business, so to speak. And dealing with operators, it was fragmented, and you probably have to do a 50% revenue share rather than a 30% revenue share. So when it was introduced, it was clearly an improvement, both in taking out friction and giving up a lesser of percentage. Now, I think if you compare it to the physical retail world, Apple and Google does much less than a physical retail store does in terms of warehousing and logistics and working capital and all this. So it's, in that sense, it's more a tax than a fair share of doing the business.
How do you define fair? What is fair?
Well, value, value contribution, and you can argue that the network effects and the platforms and so forth. But I think, they do very little work, that's for sure. Then they will claim that, you do the vetting to make sure, sure the world is safe, and, we restrict access to under 13-year-olds for this and that, and they claim they do a lot of work. But in reality, it's rather little work per app to gather 30%. If it was an open competitive environment, their share would be definitely less. And I think it's fair to say that Apple and Google should be able to enforce reasonable rules of business on their platform. But I feel that also because they are in essence a monopoly on their own platform, you can't say that this is a market price, that said. And I think some level of, I don't know if you should call it regulation or market testing, whether this is a fair part or payment for their value contribution, I think is fair. So I would say that it would be better for the long term for the ecosystem if it was 10 or 15% or something like that. And that would be more reasonable that there's some level of oversight, given that they are in the very strong market position that they are in.
How do you feel about the Epic, the gaming people charging, for these like things you buy, digital assets inside the games? Their margins on that are 90%+. So they are also making money.
This is true, but as a dad who pays too much to Epic, I feel strongly that I'm paying too much to Epic. On the other hand, the profit margins in the gaming industry broadly are much lower because it's a super competitive market, but it's also a hit-driven market. So the winners in that market make a whole lot of money, and Epic is one of them. But if you look at the long tail of the industry, it's a fast-growing, very high revenue industry, yet with a whole load of players not making any money. So you cannot claim that there's no competition in that economy.
Yeah, but I can make the same argument about Apple. There are like over 2 million apps in the App Store. Most of them are free. Apple only makes like less than $15 billion in their $250 billion revenue from the App Store. So you can say the same thing. They're doing like every year they release a new product. They're constantly improving. So there is a lot of underlying cost of, you know, have that thing available.
There are many apps, but they're all on the App Store. Otherwise, they're not in business. So as such, they're a monopoly on that platform. And yes, there are costs, but there are not costs nearly to the level where they're making revenue on it.
But you can use the browser. You don't have to have the app. Just make it, you know, available on the browser. You don't want to pay 30%.
Yeah, that's not the same user experience.
So it is providing additional value.
It is providing additional value.
So, but the question is, who decides what is the right amount they charge? Do we believe in free market, or we say it should be regulated and, you know, the government should tell them they should only charge 10% or whatever?
This is the hard one. The system in the world has always been, or in the Western world in the last 100 years or something, is that we favor a free market. Unless somebody abuses a monopoly, in which case we find a way of regulating it. And that regulation has always been imperfect. And there are no perfect way of regulating it. That doesn't mean that the general principle is to try to either break up monopolies or regulate them in a way that it's reasonably fair. And then what is fair and what is a good system? That's the real problem, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, you know, I can argue both sides of this, but I think you are more inclined towards Epic, but I'm more inclined towards Apple, because I think businesses should be able to decide how much money they can make.
Unless they're a monopoly.
No, it's like there is another option. So why isn't Google charging less? They charge the same thing. And you can go, for example, Epic Games, the revenue from Apple is less than 10%. So a lot of the usage for Fortnite happens on the browser. And for a long time, they didn't want to get into the App Store because of this reason. And, you know, people can create a new platform. You know, raise money, build a new one. It's not easy, but it's possible. So it's not like monopoly by, let's say, AT&T, that you have one phone and it only comes in this color and there's only one line going to the house. So it's a different way. So you can say, yeah, it's not fair, which I may say, yeah, it's excessive, but, you know, so are the prices in the games for digital things.
All right, we need to move on. Let's agree to disagree, and let's get to the next one where somebody's trying to regulate someone.
Before we move on, you want to say the last word on how should the entrepreneurs in Nordic countries think about this?
They should cheer for Epic loudly, and then they should follow closely how the rules will change and play accordingly.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, diversify, like use, depending on what it is, in addition to app stores, have a web version available, and also allow like 1 to 2 months for launch, because you may get stuck in the approval process, and that takes, in my experience, almost 2 months to get out of that process. It may be a tiny thing. You did, you know, check the wrong box or did something, but if you get stuck there, then it can take up to 2 months to get out of that.
Yep. Okay, painful old experience, huh?
Yeah, yeah, that experience is painful. I've been through that multiple times. But a human gets involved from Apple, and you talk, and you are able to resolve the issue. Okay, the next topic is TikTok, another issue intertwined with what the government should and should not do. So for people who are not familiar, I can give an overview. TikTok is an app available, I think, most of the Western world. There is a version of that, different version, that's only for China. So it comes from, it's owned by a company called ByteDance, which is a Chinese company. They bought another company called Musical.ly a few years ago. So the app is very popular in the US, and I have used it. The user experience is great. The issue is the US is now saying that they want to ban the app, or by November 2, it has to be sold to a US company or shut down. That's the executive order from the US president, because they are afraid that the data the app collects may be used by the Chinese government to spy on people, or, you know, who knows what. But basically, the US does not want any browsing data of the app going to China. And I want to also point out the data they collect is not any different than what, you know, Facebook, Google, all the other apps collect. It's basically you're watching videos. Yeah. So that's the issue. But I think in this whole, the ban thing, the user experience, how the app is so much better is getting lost. So I want to point out, you know, why it's so addictive or cool is it's fundamentally different than other social networks, which mainly work on, you know, who you know. So let's say you join Instagram, you know, you follow your, you know, friends, and you get content from those friends. Same in Facebook. And then they, based on hashtags, etc., they may feed you other things. But here, your feed is basically what you watch. They, you know, track everything. It's all, again, machine learning based. They see what you like, what you don't like, how much time you spend, who you share, what you like. And so that's one example. So it's fundamentally machine learning based, not based on what your friends are watching, which is a big difference. Then second, it's the creation tools are really cool. Like, you can create video for, you know, like lip sync. You don't even have to sing. Things get popular. When you join something, create something, you feel like you're joining a group. So it automatically gets propagated, and the algorithm flushes the content up to your feed depending on your behavior. And I have both. So it's funny. You basically have two tabs, people you can follow, just like in other apps, and then, or other social media apps, and there's For You feed. The content I get on For You feed is better than people I'm choosing to follow. And it's also global in nature. So I see content from, you know, the Middle East, from China, from Japan, everywhere. Then it's video only. It takes over the entire screen. So it's kind of a mix of YouTube, which is, you know, YouTube, you don't use YouTube to create content. You create content somewhere else, and then you put it on YouTube. But here, you create it on the phone, and then you propagate it to other people. So that's some of, I think, the user experience is, you know, excellent. It's the best, I would say, the social networking or entertainment app out there. The best. And it's it used to be that a few years ago we made fun of, oh, Chinese companies are copying us and they don't develop any new original products. And now we have the other thing, which is, you know, a Chinese company has created this and it is a superior product. But the ban issue is, as I said earlier, is around, you know, the data going to China. And also Facebook and Google are not allowed in China. So why should US allow a company that does similar things in the US? You want to add?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the whole ban story is the biggest soap opera and Big Bang story in tech this summer. I think it's completely outrageous. I mean, you have all the ingredients you want. It's like a catchy consumer app and user experience, right? You have national security at stake. You have the trade war aspect into it. You have a president who's completely pissed off because teenagers on TikTok hijacked his Oklahoma rally. And some blatant economic blackmail. The president has said, if TikTok is sold, the treasury should have a significant proportion of the sale price paid out. And finally, the big conspiracy that the deal between Facebook and the president is that if Facebook helps him get reelected, he'll shut down TikTok. So this has like all the conspiracies and all the madness involved. So that's, I think, is an important and interesting setting to this. But one of the things that I think is kind of interesting then, if you look at the reality, everybody claims there's this, you know, it collects dangerous data. Is there any valid, have you seen any valid claim that they collect something that Facebook and Google does not?
No.
No. So it's just completely crazy, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can see the argument that, let's say, I mean, retaliation argument, where, you know, Google and Facebook are not allowed in China, so US shouldn't allow that. But it depends how you see yourself. You want to be an exemplar of free markets, fair competition, or you want to be like how the other countries are behaving?
Okay. Have you, so this seems to be like a US-China issue that's blown up, driven by the president. Have you, you know, TikTok is big in Europe as well. Mm-hmm. Have you seen any evidence that if it's being resolved for the US, it impacts what's going on in Europe, or will it remain a US-China issue?
So what's happening is we'll see, you know, US kind of drove Huawei out of Europe as well. Mm-hmm. We'll see if they do the same here. But the current rumors or the news is Oracle is looking into buying this, supported by Sequoia Capital. Then Microsoft is looking into buying this, which I find funny. The whole Microsoft is based on increasing productivity, and this is, you know, highly unproductive. It's entertaining or entertainment. Then the Google said yesterday they're not going to buy TikTok. And there's some other rumor comes up every other day. But Kevin Mayer, the CEO that was hired to resolve this, a US CEO, he resigned yesterday or effective today because he said the role, how it is going to change. And the buying discussions are related to operations in US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. So Europe is not in those discussions. What his reason for resigning was, he signed up for a global company to build a global business, and how it's being structured or carved out, he's not interested in just doing that. So we'll see what happens. Europe is not part of these buying discussions.
Okay. One last question before we need to move on for time reasons, and that is, if Oracle buys it, will TikTok become an on-premise solution based on very expensive database licenses? Okay. It seems the answer is yes.
Well, they are moving to cloud now as well.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think in like next 2-3 minutes, you want to touch on how the visa thing is affecting Nordic entrepreneurs?
Yeah, so visa issues, and this is a US visa issue to be precise. So a lot has happened here over the last half year. So obviously tech companies, they run on capital and talent. That's kind of the main ingredients. And the tech industry has an international talent base, both founders and workers, and no place more so than Silicon Valley, so to speak. And therefore the visa and immigration system is super important. And, you know, the tech workers and founders and everything work on, you know, come from green cards on H-1B visas, on L-1 visas, on E-2 visas, on O visas. There's a whole bunch of family of visas that are important. And processing of that is, of course, important. When COVID hit, the whole process was slowed down, and then it sort of opened up again. And then in June, well, first then green card was stopped in April, and then in June, in something called Proclamation 10052, President Trump signed this executive order and temporarily halting visa work for H-1B visa, H-2B visa, some J visas, and some L visas. Essentially, these are the temporary visas, particularly the H-1B and L-1. The H-1B being like a temporary foreign worker in special occupations, which is essentially what the tech industry uses. And L1 is management transfers in companies. So that was stopped. And hence, it's a big spanner in the works of tech companies, both startups and large companies. I think like Facebook and Google and Apple and so forth, they have about between 25 and 30,000 come in to the country on this every year under normal circumstances. And the reason for this is essentially protecting American jobs, stopping foreign talent from taking over jobs that are no qualified people to take. So obviously this is something that the tech industry is a lot against. Now there's been some loosening of this if it's a national interest and so forth, but this is definitely a complication for the tech industry, and it's a complication that sort of adds to the complexity of COVID-19. It sort of adds to like the perception of the US abroad, although that hit is probably smaller, and the whole turn towards remote working and working from home that the COVID has happened. So a lot of articles are out there talking about Silicon Valley being, you know, past peak and all sorts of things in this period. So I think the whole trend is kind of interesting because it impacts a lot of things, you know, we are interested in the Nordic Silicon Valley relationship. It's in Silicon Valley, it impacts like tech companies' access to international talent. So that's an important thing. It impacts international talent who would like to work in the US, in particular in Silicon Valley, makes that harder. I think it's important in the context of competitiveness of tech companies in the US in Silicon Valley. Will this sort of drive the trend towards working from home even further, or opening up hubs in international markets to attract talent in some other location? I think it's important to like the Nordic tech community. Does this mean that we can be more competitive and attract the same talent to our hubs? I think that's something I'm interested to see what comes out of this. And I think it's important to look at what does the large tech companies do, because that will sort of maybe show the way in the large scale of things. Finally, I think, you know, Reid Hoffman said that Silicon Valley is a mindset, not a location. But so far it's been a very important location. And I think there've been sort of two driving forces to that. One is what I call serendipity by density of mind of mindset, which is related to that. Things happen in Silicon Valley because there are so many people located in the same place who do similar things and feed off each other. So will this sort of slow down, both with work from home and less talent coming, slow down that effect? That will be a loss for everyone, I think. And the question is, can it be replicated virtually and it can be replicated elsewhere? I think the better thing would be if that happened everywhere instead of slowing it down in Silicon Valley, right? But how can we make that happen? And the other thing that I think is, so far, the other sort of thing that's driven Silicon Valley is sort of the capital congregation and allocation there. Capital for tech is just much more of in Silicon Valley. And so let's say talent moves other places, will capital follow? Because the kingmakers are kind of still in Silicon Valley, and will they follow the trend? And what will we see coming out of this? But I think this sort of both the visa issue and the larger trend around this is very important, both for the Silicon Valley ecosystem and the other tech ecosystems around the world.
Yeah. Thanks, Arne. That was a very good overview. Without knowing anything about your student life, I can bet that you were a good student. Always do homework. Yeah. I can ask you a lot of questions, but let's open it up to the audience. If there are any questions.
Yes, let's see, there are questions. I can start with the first one here. From Krister, he says, can you please, I think you mean elaborate on the competition situation between Facebook and TikTok. How large is the threat against company Facebook as the social media leader?
So I can start. So Instagram released a feature within Instagram called Instagram Reels, which is kind of like TikTok, but the user experience is not the same. And even if it, you know, TikTok succeeds, I think whatever happens, I don't see Facebook dominance going away, because they're, you know, if you look at the daily active people, like unique people who use Facebook or one of the properties, WhatsApp, Messenger, Oculus, and the Blue app, it's over 3 billion monthly active users, sorry, not daily. And it just, the use is much more wide or broad. You know, TikTok is mainly entertainment. So it gives creators an easy way to create, and they see themselves as content company, because you can share what you create in TikTok with anybody on different platforms. If you try to share, you know, stuff on Facebook, Instagram, it remains within their ecosystem. So I see them more as a content company, but who knows the future. But currently I don't see the dominance going away. Like Snapchat, when it came out, it just addressed a different niche, which wasn't fulfilled, but didn't really affect Facebook so much. And it's similar here.
Do you want to add to that or no?
Well, I would just say, I don't know how big the real threat is. I'd just say that Facebook has a history for being very conscious acting on this early, right? So they bought Instagram early, they bought WhatsApp later, they've copied Snapchat aggressively, they seem to be copying TikTok. So they're clearly not taking it lightly. That doesn't mean that it's an immediate threat in any way, the way that I think about it.
Great, thank you. Next question or comment, Katya. She loves listening to you guys, we all do. She says, kind of touching on all of these topics, what should be the role of government regulating these platforms, and how much should these tech giants take responsibility of their conduct and socio-political effects? How do you see the role of US versus EU in regulation, and should they coordinate their responses in an ideal world?
I can start. I might sound like I was a real for regulation type of guy here, and I'm not really. I think you know, the government should have a minimal role in it, but they should have a role. It should definitely not be a political role. And I think it's better if it's like courts and bureaucrats and not politicians who try to do these things based on a very neutral set of rules that, and I think competitive rules competition rules are somewhat there in the law, and I think you know, it's a role of like implementing that through bureaucracy and you know, taking it to court if it doesn't happen. I don't think, you know, we should have more politicians in Brussels or Washington coming up with good reasons to having opinions about everything.
And I would say, in ideal world, there shouldn't be nation states. Look at all the conflict that exists in the world because, you know, these randomly divided, you know, earth that people fight because one has power here, one was born there, one was born here. So ideal world, there are no nation states, so there won't be any conflict. That's my idea of ideal world.
We have a little bit of a way to go before we're there, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great. I don't think we have any more questions at the moment, and we are nearing the end of the time here. So I just want to thank you so much to both of you. And thank you for everybody who joined us today. And, you know, thank you for giving us a lot of valuable input and insights and also some good laughs along the way. I envision we're going to have a new movie coming up in the future, maybe The President's Social Network. We'll see what comes up. I just wanted to say, if people have any further questions or comments, they can always reach us on our at Nordic Innovation House on our Bifrost page, which has our contact information. The recording from today will be also posted on that page. And just remember to check back in with us for future talks. And big thank you again to the two of you. And also remind everybody to follow your podcast, Valley Nordic. And we also have that posted on our Bifrost page. So more interesting talks to come from you guys, and love the discussion and the highlights, and hope it was valuable for everybody. So see you again next time. And thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Asta. And thanks, Kelly, for organizing.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
And thanks to the audience for joining. Okay, bye.
Thank you. Bye.